happens after death has been part of our human condition. And all, I think, at the center of pretty much all religious and spiritual traditions, since we first gained consciousness of death, and that probably was before we became what's classified as human. You know, there are animals, like particularly elephants, if you read about elephants, that have a keen awareness of the death of one of their family members, and they'll go and they'll go back to the site of the bones and they'll caress the bones with their trunks. So, and even animals with so-called lesser intelligence seem to have some awareness. Remember when I was working in hospice doing some trainings, and we did a training where a woman worked with severely handicapped individuals in a group home, and she described two men, young men, both of whom nonverbal, very, very handicapped, and one died, and the other would stand by the window holding the socks of his roommate. And that's how he showed his sadness. So yeah, deep part of our human condition. You know, many of us remember our first encounter with death and in childhood. And for many, you know, because in our contemporary world, death is more shielded. It happens in hospitals, most often out of view of children, where in earlier times, children would see death very early, especially, and then animal death, of course, living on farms. So for many of us, the death of a pet is our first encounter. Hold up your hand if the death of a pet had a significant impact for you early on. Yeah, me too. And then some of us do experience the death of a family member, close family member, early on too. And that's often a kind of wake up call or an awakening of questioning. How can a being be so full of life in one moment and so absent in the next? You know, great mystery. So still, there's nothing quite as still as a being right after death, you know, so still. Where do we come from? Where do we go? In Zen, we call it the great matter of life and death, right? And we engage with those questions, with that mystery. Zen master Toshuai created three questions to help his students engage with the great matter. And if you want to look them up, they're in the Mumonkan, the Gateless Barrier, case 47. Here they are. I really love these. I find these really beautiful. The first one is, you make your way through the darkness of abandoned grasses in a single-minded search for your self-nature. Now, honored one, where is your nature? So you just need to know that in Zen language, grasses are the 10,000 things, the myriad things of the phenomenal world, you know? Also called the dusty world. The grasses are our stuff. And of course, the term self-nature is referring to our true nature, our big nature, beyond the small construct of our individual self. And then the second question is, when you have realized your self-nature, you are free of birth and death. When the light of your eyes falls, how are you free? And then the third is, when you are free from of birth and death, you know where to go. When your four elements scatter, where do you go? These are his three questions, and I really find them quite powerful and beautiful. And they're almost impossible to answer in words, right? I mean, how would you answer them? Perhaps, except through poetry. And the great poets have been doing that for ages, answering those very questions, or attempting to. Really, the answers can only be apprehended through direct experience, you know, through those glimpses that we get when our mind is unobstructed and clear. But if we really closely observe our body and mind every day, our everyday body and mind, right, every day Zen, in the world around us, we'll see that life and death are going on inside us and outside us all the time. I mean, just stop and think about your cells right now. Right now, there are cells just dying and coming into being, right in your very body. Not only the ones that are technically yours, but think that you're full of, I forget what the percentage, but this is a huge percent of our body mass that isn't even ours. It's the, you know, the microbiome in our gut and all the little mites crawling around in our skin. And they're living and dying in and on us right now. Not to mention the rest of the world. You know, so if we just pay attention and notice, we can do, you know, in the early Buddhists, the Buddha sent the monks out to the charnel grounds to observe bodies in decay. My version of that is stopping for roadkill. I like to stop and kind of give a little moment of reverence and sorrow for the roadkill, and then if I'm able to remove it to the side of the road so that the ravens don't get killed coming down to eat it. And so the raccoon or whoever, the squirrel can go back to the earth instead of the pavement. But, you know, we have opportunities to observe life and death all the time if we're paying attention. I think of the Tibetan Buddhists as being the technicians of dying and after-death experience. And there are sources available to you if you want to learn about that. But that's not my training, so I won't try and teach it. There's much we can learn from that tradition, but not all of it converts that well to Western culture. I think Zen takes a less technical, even irreverent approach, as we will see in the koan literature. So first maybe we can look at a koan from the Blue Cliff Record, case 55. It goes like this. I'm sure many of you have heard it. Master Dawu and his disciple, Qianwan, went to a house to make a condolence call. Probably they were going to recite sutras for the dead. That would be typical. And Yuan, the disciple, knocks on the coffin and says, "Alive or dead?" And Master Dawu replies, "I won't say alive and I won't say dead." Yuan Wu says, "Why won't you say?" "I won't say." So they head back to the monastery, and Yuan Wu is really frustrated with his teacher. So he says again, "Tell me right now, teacher. If you don't tell me, I'll hit you." And Dao Wu says, "You may hit me, but I won't say." So Yuan Wu gave his teacher a whack, which seems like a pretty drastic thing to do. I wouldn't recommend it. and soon after, he left the monastery at Dao Wu's suggestion to practice with another master, Shishuang. And later on, we don't some years maybe, he heard the news that his first teacher Dao Wu had died. And he went to Shishuang and told him the story of his earlier altercation with his former teacher. And Shishuang said, "I won't say alive and I won't say dead." Wan Wu said, "Why won't you say?" Shishuang said, "I won't say, I won't say." And at those words, Wan Wu was awakened and finally understood the great wisdom and compassion of his old master's refusal to give him the answer. And even later, one day, Yuan Wu took a hoe into the Dharma hall and started walking back and forth with the hoe. And Shishuang asked him, "What are you doing?" He said, "I'm looking for the relics of my late master." And Shishuang replied, "Vast waves spread far and wide, foaming billows flood the skies. What relics of your late master are you looking for?" Wang Wu said, "This is just where I should apply effort." So we don't really know quite what he meant by that, but the commentary says, the late master's relics are still present. So the suggestion is that he wanted to draw on his old master's strength to fortify his practice. And I guess the hoe is the right tool. But I think any of you who have ever felt the presence of a loved one who has died and felt that mysterious way that our connection to the dead spans space and time in ways that we don't really understand will understand Yuan Wu's connection to the relics of his teacher. I think, you know, I've been taking daily woodland walks out here where I am in woodland that really resembles the woodland of my childhood where I spent a lot of time. They're big hardwood trees, and of course their spring foliage has come out over the weeks that I've been here, and all the birds, just incredible richness of birds and birdsong. And of course, my mom, who died a year ago, I arrived just in time for the anniversary of her death, taught me those birds. She taught me their names, she taught me their songs before I could even read. And so when I walk, I feel like she's just, you know, right there commenting on that one and that one. And the flowers, the wild, incredible, lovely wildflowers too. So it's kind of like her relics are right there with me. So, going back to the koan from Wednesday evening, for those of you who were there, about our friend Dongshan, who was lying in his sickbed, if you remember, and asked about, is there one who is not sick? And he said, yes, does the one who is not sick take care of you? And he said, I have the opportunity to take care of him, of the one who is not sick. So there's sort of simultaneous giving and receiving of the one who is sick and the one who is not sick, who might be another person, who might be oneself, right? Both sick and not sick. And so this koan continues. It's a long commentary. with an account of how two old Zen masters met their death. And the first one is Dongshan, same guy. When he realized he was nearing his death, he asked one of his monks, "When I leave this leaking husk, where will you go to meet me?" And as is so often the case in these stories, the monk was unable to reply. So Dongshan composed a verse. "Though students are many, not one is awakened. The mistake lies in pursuing the path of others' tongues. If you want to be able to let go of the body and leave no trace, practice diligently to walk in emptiness. So he's saying, you know, if you want to be able to let go of your life when the time comes, practice walking in emptiness now. Don't cling. Not to your body, not to your teacher, not to the teachings themselves, let alone that parking spot that you just missed. So he's saying, you know, vast reality is beyond these words. And after reciting that verse, he shaved his head one last time. He sat down in Zazen. He rang a bell, said farewell to the assembly, and died. The monks wailed in grief. Dongshan opened his eyes again, requested that a meal for stupidity be prepared. He extended his life for 7 more days and again bade everyone farewell, sat in Zazen, and died. This story echoes the story of the Buddha himself, delaying his death so that he could prepare the Sangha and get them ready and make sure they were going to be okay. So the second story takes place several generations later. This time it's Master Fajing, and his attendant was reading the story of Dongshan's death from the record of Dongshan. And he came to this part about Dongshan dying, and he said, "That man of old was quite extraordinary." And Fajing, the master teacher, said, "After I die, you can call to me. If I can return, this will be because of having the power of the way." So you have the feeling that there's a little like one-upmanship going on here. He's saying, "Oh, I can do better than Dongshan." So later, when he knew that his death was near, Fajing composed and recited a verse. That's, you know, that was kind of mandatory in those days to write a death verse. So his went like this. "This year, in the first week of the 5th month, the 4 gross elements will leave their host. Let the white bones be exposed to the wind and spare finding a plot from a donor." So he's saying, in other words, just leave me out in the open, save the expense of an expensive burial plot. Let the white bones be exposed to the wind. So he gave his clothing and his few belongings to his attendant to sell to make money for the monastery. And then at the sound of the night bell, he sat in Zazen and died. And then his attendant said, "According to our old pact, you asked me to call you." So he called 3 times. Fajing went, "What?" The attendant asked, "Why are you going naked and barefoot?" Remember, he had sold his clothes. He'd given his clothes away. And Fajing said, "What did I have when I came into this life?" His attendant tried to put a robe on him, but Fajing stopped him and said, leave that for others later." The attendant protested, "But what about now?" And Fajing said, "It's just thus. It's just thus." He's just saying, this is what's happening now. It's just, I'm dying. Don't try and turn away or busy yourself. Just face it. So here he is, taking care of his attendant, even though he's the one who's dying, just like Dongshan, the sick and the not sick, the dying and the not dying. So he recites one more verse. 73 years, so that's how old he was, 73 years, like a lightning flash. "About to go, for you I put a thread through." So he's saying, "I'm delaying my death for you. I'm keeping that thread of connection to help you let go." What a lovely image, huh? And then he says, the iron ox leaps past Korea, smashing into the emptiness, shattering it into pieces. Wow. So the iron ox is a symbol of determined practice. So for this old wise man, his dying is an act of determined letting go. Wansong, who wrote the commentary to the Blue Cliff Record, says, Dongshan knew the one who isn't ill. Fajing knew the one who doesn't die. Therefore, those two elders came and went freely. When the ancients were about to go, they frolicked in the realm of old age, sickness, and death. Great imagining, a great image, these old Zen guys frolicking in the realm of old age, sickness, and death. But they were not only playful, they were caring, even in their last illness, even nearing death. And while they're still living, they're vividly alive, even when they're ill. And when they die, they face their dying head on. Now, this may seem to set an impossibly high standard for us, don't you think? But there's even further commentary, further discussion. So bear with me, because I think they have something important to say. In the Blue Cliff Record, there's a verse by Hongjir, one of our early ancestors, who wrote a verse for each koan, and this is the one for this koan. Taking off the smelly skin bag, casting away the mass of red flesh, directly the nose is straight, immediately the skull is dry. Sounds a little cryptic. The nose is straight and the skull is dry refer to emptiness, boundlessness. So he's describing letting go of our attachment to our body, our old smelly skin bag, and opening to the boundlessness of true nature. So in the commentary then, Wansong quotes from Sherdo's Song of the Grassroot Hermitage, and many of us will remember that from a couple of different times we've studied and chanted the Song of the Grassroot Hermitage, and its closing lines, if you remember, are, if you want to know the undying person in the hut, do not separate from this skin bag here and now. So Wansong points out that Hongjir, with the first poem, and Dongshan were both descendants of Sherdo. Sherdo was the really early ancestor. And yet Hongjir is saying, drop off the smelly skin bag, and Dongshan says, attend to and nurture the body when it's out of tune. So this is contradictory. How can they be reconciled, says Wansong. But maybe those seeming contradictions are embedded in the human condition. Maybe both are telling us to practice walking in emptiness, and when the time comes to let go, you'll be able to. But until then, do not separate from this skin bag. Attend and nurture when it's out of tune. See, it's both. All this reminds me of closing lines from a poem by Mary Oliver that go like this. To live in this world, you must be able to do three things. To love what is mortal, to hold it against your bones, knowing your own life depends on it, and when the time comes to let it go, to let it go. So Wansong takes the conversation even further with a series of dialogues. And to understand these dialogues, you need to understand a couple of bits of imagery. So, a dragon in a dead tree, eyeballs in a dry skull, are symbols for awakening to the truth of emptiness. So the the dragon in the dead tree, and eyeballs in an empty, dry skull. Symbols of emptiness, our lives scoured out of self-clinging. So that's the perspective of wisdom. Right? So first dialogue. A monk asks Xiangyang, what is the way? A dragon roaring in a dead tree. Monk says, I don't understand. Xiangyang, eyeballs in a dry skull. That all sounds a bit grim. But listen to this next exchange. Yet another monk and another Zen master. Okay, this time, monk asks, what is a dragon roaring in a dead tree? Shishuang, Zen master, answers, still having joy. What are eyeballs in a dry skull? Still having consciousness. So, to me, this is now the perspective of compassion coming in. These answers suggest that as long as we are alive in these skin bags, that being free from self-clinging does not preclude still having joy, still having consciousness. This is how we live in this world, right? With a kind of flexibility, lightness, and care for suffering beings. This is how Bodhisattva lives in the world of sickness, old age, and death. How we offer ourselves just as we are, with all our human frailties and limitations, even when we are on our sickbed or our deathbed, how we offer our life to all beings. So the perspective of wisdom, the perspective of compassion, the two wings of our practice that we need to have in balance to fly. Okay, one more dialogue. This time, monk asks, what is a dragon howling in a dead tree? Yet another Zen master replies, the bloodline is not cut off. So, human connection is still alive, even in emptiness. And what are eyeballs in a dry skull? And he says, not entirely dry. Not entirely dry. We're still alive, right? So if we think that we should be in this perfect detached state of emptiness, we are cutting off that blood connection and hampering our ability to live the life of a bodhisattva in this world. So as you can see from the density of this presentation, this commentary, this great matter of life and death is something that Zen masters and their students have been wrestling with for centuries, for human beings have been wrestling with, questioning, wondering about for centuries. You know, it all comes down with that to that human acquisition of self-consciousness. And with that, the constricted, narrow definition of what our self is. Self versus other. And with that comes self-awareness of suffering. So awareness of our own suffering, awareness of the suffering of others. How do we live with that awareness without succumbing to despair and paralysis? How can we still have joy? How can we keep the bloodline of connection flowing for as long as we live? One of my favorite quotes is a prose paragraph from the American novelist Barbara Kingsolver. Here's what she has to say. Every one of us is called on, I've read this before, so if this sounds familiar to some of you, I think it bears repeating. Every one of us is called on, probably many times, to start a new life. A frightening diagnosis, a marriage, a move, loss of a job or a limb or a loved one, a graduation, bringing a new baby home. Notice these aren't all bad things, but they're new beginnings, right? And loss of what came, of what went before, even with those new beginnings, you know, a marriage, a graduation. In my own worst seasons, I've come back from the colorless world of despair by forcing myself to look hard for a long time at a single glorious thing. The flame of a red geranium outside my bedroom window. And then another, my daughter in a yellow dress. And another, the perfect outline of a full dark sphere behind the crescent moon. Until I learn to be in love with my life again, like a stroke victim, retraining new parts of the brain to grasp lost skills, I have taught myself joy over and over again. So as we emerge, maybe tentatively, from the strain and anxiety and isolation of the pandemic, we are called upon to start a new life. Right? To teach ourselves joy, to be a kind of phoenix rising from the ashes, almost. To rebuild trust in face-to-face relationships. Like, maybe we're feeling a little shy about that. I think the best way to practice with the great matter of life and death is simply to pay attention to our daily lives, to all the small births and deaths happening every day. And we can practice letting go of those small losses, frustrations, disappointments, things that we wanted to go our way. You know, practice with the little ones. Yeah. Right after my mom died, I dropped two really favorite teacups. You know, you get clumsy sometimes when you're just, you know, kind of wobbly. But it was, each time I did that, I went, ah, yeah, wow. And I kind of bowed to the teacup and said, it was great. You were a great teacup while you lasted. So we practice. With each breath, with each moment, we live and die. The whole universe flickers in and out of being. So you might want to remember those beautiful questions of Toshui. Yeah. Make your way through the darkness of abandoned grasses in a single-minded search for your self nature. Where is your nature? And when you've realized your self nature, you are free of birth and death. When the light of your eyes falls, how are you free? And when you are free of birth and death, you know where to go. When your four elements scatter, where do you go? So, please, honored bodhisattvas, please live and die and practice wholeheartedly. That's all you have to do. And when it doesn't feel wholehearted, there's the one who is wholehearted right there beside you to help, right inside and all around. Yeah, so let us go forth. Let us continue in good company. Thank you all for being here on this almost closing day. We'll meet again tomorrow for a little while. Those who can join, please do. Let's chant. Thank you, everyone.